Wahino amalana Elohino alino ma asedeno konana alino ma asedeno konanik.
Shalom aleichem, baruchim abayim. Welcome everyone. Be'ezrat Hashem, we're continuing in our second lesson in the book of Genesis, Sefer Bereshit. We are continuing in our discussions. We are now on day 3 of creation. As I was mentioning, we were discussing the very important and essential ingredient in understanding the creation story, the name Elohim. The name of God, which, as we understand from the original Hebrew, with references to Hebrew numerology, the Gematria, that the name Elohim is, as I said, numerically equal to the Hebrew term Teva, which means nature. And we learn from this that God, Elohim, is that revelation of God which is underlying nature. Now, God has his, if you will, supernatural face, which we call the name Yud-Ke-Vav-Ke, which is actually going to be revealed to us in Genesis chapter 2, with the retelling of the story of the creation of man, which is actually a little different from the story as told just verses before at the end of what we call chapter 1. But we'll discuss that in its time. Right now, in the formation of the forces of the universe, the world, we're talking really about, I'll use a word knowing how some people might not agree, but we're talking about the scientific part of the Torah, which speaks about the evolution of the universe. And I add evolution because the concept evolution, as we know, means development in progressive stages. Well, as the Bible makes very, very clear, the universe is made in progressive stages. That's why we have day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, and of course the rest, Shabbat on day 7. Now, however you want to look at it, whenever you have progression, that is by definition evolution. So therefore, you could easily have said, well, God could have just snapped his almighty divine fingers and the world would have just turned on, just if you will, like electricity running through a circuit. Well, yeah, that's all well and good, but God did not make the world like that. The real difference, in my opinion, between the what I have to define as the radical, agendaized, secular, scientific community today, with its views of evolution, and what Torah teaches, is really, in my opinion, a simple point. I don't believe we should disagree on the idea of evolution, as much as science will not acknowledge a guiding hand. They believe everything is random. And I believe that it has been shown statistically that the random combination of things could not possibly have occurred within the frame of time and existence that we have. So therefore, I believe that even from a scientific, secular point of view, we have what's to argue? How's that? What's it to argue to say that there is definitely a higher hand behind the progression and movement of things? Now, this is where I might add science and, I don't know if I should use the word religion or spirituality here, this is where we have a major separation. You see, our modern day science, like I said before, in my opinion, I believe definitely has its own agenda. Meaning, it wants to prove something that it itself wants to believe is true. It does not want to believe there is a creator. It does not want to believe that there is a higher or invisible hand. And therefore, they will, maybe skewer is a harsher word to use, but maybe an accurate word, skewer findings to discount anything which falls outside of the acceptable parameters. You can comment and say, gee, well, that's what the religious do. And I might respond and say, well, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, if you have heresy, heresy can be on both sides. I have long said that secularism is in and of itself like a religion, as any other religion is, and each has its own set of secret cow beliefs that, God forbid, you ever challenge, you will be attacked. And I don't believe secularism and modern science is any different in that respect. I believe that by understanding the clear text of what our Torah is teaching us, it'll help us bridge the gaps of extremism from the fundamentalists of both camps. And my hope and prayer is by understanding what the Torah teaches us, recognizing the reality of the world around us, and helping to neutralize, as I said, all the fundamentalist extremist points of view. So, evolution. We spoke about the name of God, Elohim, the force and power behind creation, or what we might refer to it as the force and power behind nature. Now, the universe is not God. The universe is the revelation of the hand of God. Nature is not God, but nature operates in accordance to the laws of God. And therefore, what we can refer to as the laws of nature are, by definition, the laws of Elohim, or the laws of God. And I can prove it to you. Go to stand on the top of a building and jump off. Now, you can all proclaim all that you want, God's grace, God's love, God's embracing, and you're still going to smack and hit the ground and kill yourself. Because the law of God, which is the law of nature, which is the law of gravity, is going to make you smack and kill yourself. That's just the way things are. So those people who wish to endeavor and say, well, the law is one thing, then we have grace. Grace is a philosophical concept, which is not necessarily imbued within the laws of nature. And I believe that's very important. And matter of fact, it underlines a fundamental teaching of our holy rabbis who state, and he states it very clearly. I was about to tell you in the Hebrew, but I said, ah, what the heck. Do not rely on miracles, they tell us. Ein somchim al hanes. Many people today, unfortunately, get themselves into positions in life where in which, good gosh, they dug themselves into a pit and a hole, and they don't know how to get out. And they'll turn to God and expect God to clean up the mess that they themselves have made. This is to what our sages say, don't rely on miracles. If heaven chooses to intervene and, if you will, overrule nature by what we can call the supernature or supernatural, that's God's choice, not yours and mine. And unfortunately, we develop an attitude of arrogance where we expect heaven to extricate us from our own predicaments. And this is, in a way, a very immature understanding of spirituality, and why, in my opinion, understanding well Genesis chapter 1 is important, because it helps us keep focus about where we rely and where we stand in the world. We put so much faith in our science and our technologies, and we distance and divorce ourselves from the fundamental message of what Genesis 1 has to teach us, as I'm going to proceed and we're going to talk about. Day 3, to get back now to our text. First thing, it says here, Elohim, God, said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered to one place, and the dry land shall be seen. And it happened. God named the dry land earth, and again, the gathering of the waters, he named seas. God saw that it was good. Okay. Now, an interesting point here. On the waters that we're talking about here, and the earth that we're talking about here, exactly the physical application that we're talking about? Was the earth originally covered completely by ocean, and then somehow, somewhere, the tectonic plates moved, and then the waters receded, and the earth came to bear? I am not enough of a geological expert that I can comment on that as to what modern science, which may or may not be accurate in their views, have to say on the subject. But judging from the fact that in day two, we were speaking about the waters beneath the heavens and the waters above the heavens, and we learned that the waters were by definition something other than physical H2O. My question is, are the waters that we're speaking about here on day three the same or not? I conclude by preponderance of the text as in traditional Hebraic style writing and understanding is that there is most likely a two-tier or a two-level understanding of the text. Now, I've shared with you in other introductory lessons about the ways and methods of Hebraic thinking, how it is not Greek or Roman in prose form, literally logical, rational type of formulation, as fundamentalists come to understand the English version of what they call the Bible. The Hebrew Bible has multiple levels and layers of understanding to it, implied within the text. And some of these are going to become rather clear as we continue here, especially on day three. And therefore, when we're talking about the earth and the waters, yes, I believe it is, as we say in Hebrew, kepshuto, which means as exactly as it says physically. But judging and understanding how we've come to know day two, I must understand day three as a continuation. And I wonder if the separation of water and earth is actually the progression and the development of the physical foundations of what we call form. That the waters, as we described, were this prima mater, this original form from which everything came forth, and the earth we recognize as being not only the physical ground upon which we walk, but a metaphor for all physical space. And physical space includes within it the four elements of what we call fire, air, water, and earth. Or if you will, energy, gas, liquid, solid states of matter. And that's exactly what I believe we're dealing with here. That there was a division. And that the waters, this prima mater, is actually what we refer to as that life force energy from which everything comes forth. And that the earth, then, is the place where in which the life will come forth. Because you will note that we then proceed in day three here to discuss trees and fruits and stuff like that. And later, as we proceed into day five, we speak about all of the creatures, the fish of the sea being created, if you will. An interesting point that is not made, is not even referenced, is that nowhere does it speak about vegetative development under the sea, which obviously would be necessary for the life of this under the sea to exist. It has to be there. We obviously know it is there. The Torah doesn't mention it. I find that a curious omission. And I don't know really what to make of it. But let's proceed in the text and we'll continue. We have now the earth. We have now the seas. We understand that, if you will, spiritually. And now we're going to try to stay focused on the physical. Now pay attention. God said, let the earth shall send forth vegetation. All right? Vegetation has to be the fundamental foundation of life. Seed-bearing plants and fruit trees that produce their own kind of fruits with seeds shall be on the earth. And it happened. Now listen to the next verse. The earth sent forth vegetation, just like God said it should. Plants bearing their own kind of seeds. Seed-bearing plants, just like God said it would. And trees producing fruits containing their own kind of seeds. If you paid attention, that's not what God said. God said fruit trees that produced their own kinds of fruits, and what came forth were trees producing fruits. Not fruit trees, but trees producing fruits. Now, there is no coincidence. There is no oversights. When you have a specific terminology in the original Hebrew text, it has a very precise meaning. So therefore, when the Hebrew says in the original, "Etz peri ose peri," a fruit tree that makes fruit, and then what got created was an etz ose peri, a tree that produces fruits, as opposed to a fruit tree, there's something missing. And our rabbis picked up on this, and they noticed that this is a subtle little hint that creation did not fully follow the pattern that God had originally ordained. If you will, a glitch in the system. This is not a semantical difference. This is something actual. Apparently, according to how we understand it, trees were originally meant to be fruit themselves and not just producers of fruit as we see it today. Now, we can go out to our garden and pick off lemons or oranges or apples from our fruit trees. But yet you would not take a bite out of the trunk of the tree itself. Apparently, initially, the trunk of the tree was supposed to have been a form of fruit itself, and for whatever reason, this did not materialize. Standard commentators do not necessarily expound on the meaning of this. However, in the secret teachings of the Kabbalah, this matter is discussed, and it's said to be significant. A point that our sages make in the teachings of the Kabbalah is that the creation story that we have here today is not necessarily the first of God's creations. As I believe I shared with you the Torah legend that prior to God creating the universe, our rabbis teach that God created and destroyed other universes. That there was these other existences before our own. And we're now not really at the page one of the story, but if you will, just page one of the newest chapter. And that's why we spoke of the word Bereshit, not as being a point in time, but if you will, a point in place. So, apparently there was a blemish. Now, in the mystical language of the Kabbalah, they referred to this as the fallen vessels, the breaking of the vessels, the original existence of what we call evil. Now, if you will remember, it's stated clearly in Genesis 1, God created light, but it never said he created darkness. Darkness was already there. In a point that the prophet Isaiah makes very clearly, it says, God created both light and darkness. Yotzer or borei hoshech. Osei shalom uborei ra. God formed light and created darkness. He makes good and he created evil. God is the author of evil. God is the author of darkness. He created both of these things. And yet somehow, their creation is left out of our telling at this time. Our sages learn from this. If obviously they are here, and obviously they are created, and obviously their creation is not mentioned here, and they're already there, then they were obviously created before the word Bereshit. Now this is important, because this really helps us understand the entire nature and process that's happening here. As we know from the story, evening comes before day. Darkness comes before light. Just like darkness came before light in the original creation. God created evil before he created good. And you can say, well, why? Good gosh, it's terrible. He created evil so that good can come and shine out of it. He enables us to make mistakes so that by overcoming our mistakes, we have merit, we have reward, we have benefit. I've given this metaphor before and I'll share with you it again. Compare it, if you will, to someone who inherits $1 billion, without any understanding of fiscal responsibility, a person can come and squander that $1 billion over a matter of a few years and be left poor and destitute. Where in which if an individual works hard, long hours, and builds their empire and works to create that $1 billion themselves, they understand responsibility, fiscal obligations, and therefore will safeguard and protect their well-earned wealth and use it wisely. God created us in this exact same way. He could have given us everything all at a start, but knowing human nature as we are as human beings, we would have squandered what we had. And therefore, He gives us the opportunity to work to earn our keep. And this is what we, of course, call reward and punishment. And that is why darkness came first, because if light came first, and then darkness came, it's kind of like you're doing something, you always do it, and now another choice comes, and you're, I'm not going to do another choice, I'm going to just stick with what I'm doing. It's by rote, it's automatic, almost lazy. So therefore, God created evil first. No, we were not created in evil. We were actually told to stay away from evil, if you remember the story of Adam, that we'll get to as we proceed. But yet, it was present, even in the Garden of Eden. And we were given a choice. We were told, choose good, not bad. We had the opportunity. We were created innocent and told to choose good. And that is the secret here of what we have. That even in creation, the fruit trees did not manifest the way they were meant to do. But yet, even so, God saw that this too was good. And it was evening, and it was morning, a third day. Third level of creation. Vegetation has begun. Conscious, sentient life is soon to follow. But now, in recognizing this relationship of light and dark, understand now is how we proceed to day four. This might sound a little queer and unusual in placement, but no, it's not. Day four. God said, let there be lights in the heavenly sky to divide the day and the night. They shall serve as omens to define festivals, days, and years. There should be lights in the heavenly sky to shine on the earth. And it happened. God thus made the two large lights, the greater one to rule the day, the smaller one to rule the night. He also made the stars. God placed them in the heavenly sky to shine on the earth, to rule by day, to rule. Do you hear that word? To rule. Verse 18. Limshol. Memshala is the root for the word government. They rule by day and by night and divide the light and the darkness. God said it was good, evening and morning, day four. Now, I would naturally assume that the lights of the heavens, if we're talking about a historical progression of evolution, should have been day two. Right? First comes the light, spiritual light, then comes the physical light, and then day three should have been separating day and waters, and day four should have been the creating of vegetation, and day five, the life that comes forth. But no, it's placed here in day four, kind of out of order. Why is this? This is how come we understand days two and three, possibly within a context of spiritual applications before physical. But what the important point of day four is telling us is the relationship of time to space. Space now has been established on day three, the earth. Day four now comes to teach us about time itself. Here is one of the greatest dangers that we as humanity has ever created. And believe it or not, most of us have it right now on our wrists. I'm talking about clocks, time. Yes, even our watches. What time is it? All right, I can look at my watch and I can say, oh, 9:30, 10:30, 11, 12. No. What time is it? What that should mean to you is that you should be able to walk outside, look up at the sun, and say it's the second, third, fourth, or fifth hour of the day. You should be able to look to the stars at night
and recognizes the first, third, fourth, fifth portion of the night. And we have lost this natural relationship of movement. And this is a devastating spiritual loss. God created everything in the universe in a way to operate like the intricate parts of, like a clock, if you will. The universe is the divine clock. Isaac Newton, in his Newtonian physics, stated how everything pretty much works mechanically. Well, at the level of the name Elohim, that is true. And of course, modern physics, quantum and superstring, are introducing to us the other higher elements of physics underlying that. But the point that I'm trying to emphasize is human nature, earthly nature, universal nature, all operate in a very closely connected, interdependent system of the flow and movement of the stars. Many of you might already be guessing what I'm discussing. And yes, I have to say, I am talking about astrology. But here, when I mention that word, I can hear people gasp, Rabbi, but isn't astrology idolatry and evil? Well, it can be, yes. But it doesn't have to be, no. Are you saying, Rabbi, that we should look at our horoscope and predict the future? No, exactly. I'm telling you that that's the bad and evil part of it. And the prophets were very clear to tell people, cast aside such nonsense. Whereas at the same time, it was these same exact prophets who would be experts of the movement of the stars, of the planets, recognizing by their movements, as it says in Kohelet, a time and a purpose for all things under heaven. Now, just to help you have a little insight into astrological symbols. As we know, the planet Earth goes around its orbit. And as it's going around its orbit around the Sun in a period of 365 and a quarter days, which is revolutions of the Earth, in that time that takes to go around the Sun, it moves in a backdrop of stars in the sky. Those stars we call the constellations. We have, from ancient days, mapped out 12 precise star patterns and given them mythological names, which we call the 12 signs of the zodiac. Why 12? 12 actually is a rather important number in the Torah. We know the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 months of the year. And even in the teachings of the Kabbalah, there are other deeper and mystical understandings that 12 is the number, if you will, of the parameters of space-time. That you have up, down, in and out, right and left, six parameters of dimension which make up a three-dimensional world. But again, we said we had heavens and the earth, so you have like a double dimension, 12 in total. So we live in a 12-dimensional world, and good gosh, we know three of them, which are really six. But what are the others? Well, that's that invisible world that we don't really see. They are all ruled here, as it says in verse 18, by the powers of the stars in the heavens. Now, let me explain mechanically, because that's a correct word here, how this works. God set up, as we know, the laws of nature. And he set up things to be influenced in specific orders and specific ways at specific times. So, as Solomon wrote, there's nothing new under the sun. To every time and purpose, you know, there's season under heaven. Time to be born, a time to be die, and a time for war, a time for peace. You can go to Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, and read all those things there. What this is saying is this, that there are natural orders in the cycles of time which are more inducive and helpful to certain things than others. A soul that comes down from heaven and is born onto earth is born into this mechanical machinery here of time and, of course, space. And the stars and the planets are in a specific arrangement at the time of one's entry into the universe, and therefore reflect or reveal the place from which the soul came. Now, here's the difference between, if you will, idolatrous astrology and, if you will, you could say kosher astrology. You see, astrology does not predict to us anything. And anyone who wants to predict through astrology is committing idolatry. However, the power of the stars do not, let me repeat that, the power of the stars do not dictate to you anything. However, they reveal to you where you came from in light of this world. So, your soul comes down from heaven into this world with a purpose, a design, a mission. And therefore, does God just haphazardly throw you down to earth? What are you, like a meteor that's just going to crash into the planet? No. You come through the machinery of the system, if you will, at that precise moment, through that precise doorway, in that precise place, which is best and conducive for you to fulfill your mission. There are no such things as mistakes from heaven. And therefore, if, for example, you were born into a family in Texas, New York, Jerusalem, a family of non-Jews, a family of non-religious Jews, a family of religious Jews, none of this is by coincidence or accident. And by the nature of your birth, by understanding the star patterns which rule over us, we can recognize and understand, if you will, what I call a spiritual Rorschach. Rorschach was that ink blot test that they do in psychology that helps you project the personality through what you see from inside. The stars work in a similar way. What they do is define personality and nature. So you will find that those people born under a certain sign have a certain type of personality to them. Can they therefore change? We are taught that when God breathed into us the breath of life, we had the opportunity to change and rise from that name Elohim to the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. And so therefore we do have the opportunity to rise above one's innate, inborn nature, one's astrological influence. And this is important, because we say those who truly rise to being a servant of the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, which means that we can truly embrace our spiritual origins in nature, which are above the creation of time and space, then we can truly rise above this. One of the great examples of this, our rabbis teach us, was none less than Moses himself. That by nature of his birth and his astrology, Moses was not destined to be who he was, but yet rose above it. And indeed before him, so did Abraham. So the path of the Abrahamic faith, the Mosaic faith, is to teach us how to rise above these influences, whereas at the same time recognizing that their influence imbues the world around us, and that will not change. But we are part of the world and above the world. We are in the world, but not of the world. When we live in accordance to natural time, we can see the hand and flow and movement of God in creation. When we divorce ourselves from natural time, the presence of God becomes invisible to us. And that is why when we live in our modern society by artificial time, as defined on the hands of a clock, and we don't flow with natural cycles, this affects us spiritually and psychologically, and, I might add, affects us physically and can be the cause of ill health. Each of us has within us in something instinctual called a biological clock, wherein which it is natural within the very genes of our being to at times be alert and awake, and at times to be drowsy and asleep. We fight these because we want to be awake to go out to dinner. We want to be awake to go out to the movies. We're so divorced from the concept that rest is the period of the evening and the night. And therefore, when the night comes, we're still going strong until 10, 11, until the middle of the night. And we wonder why we wake up in the morning and we're still tired. We define time by the movement of the stars, the planets. The year is defined by the Earth revolving around the Sun. A month is defined by the Moon revolving around the Earth. A day is defined by the Earth revolving upon itself. The concept of a week, of 7 days being a block of time, we would have had to have had a revelation, as we know, of the Holy Sabbath, to have made that aware to us. Otherwise, that would not have been known to us naturally. And that's why we speak of the Holy Sabbath as being, in the Jewish tradition, corresponding to the entire Torah, because it connects us to the supernatural, that power of Yud Gei Vav Gei. But now continuing and understanding, other cultures have had other calendars. In Mesoamerica, meaning the ancient peoples who lived in the North and Central American continent, these people were experts in calculating the flow and movement of time. They can see when planets aligned and were arranged, and through centuries of observations recognized that these alignments and arrangements had clear and overt significance here upon the Earth. Now, every scientist will tell you that at periods of full moons, there is a definite influence upon the waves of the ocean. There is a definite connection between the gravity of the moon and the pull on the oceans. Everyone in science knows that. But now go and speak to somebody in law enforcement, and they will tell you that when the full moon occurs, things go nuts. People go crazy. They have more calls of more bizarre behaviors at the full moon than at any other time of the month. Why is that so? People say, coincidence. No. You don't think that the same influence of the moon over the waters in the ocean don't affect, if you will, the waters and flow in your brain? Yes, they do. And it affects personality. It affects and influences behavior. Yes, of course, we can rise above it. But most choose not to. And just like the moon has this clear influence, so does every other planet. So the ancient Incas, the Aztecs, who could calculate, if you will, what I said, the almost Newtonian mechanics of the flow and movement of time, could look and recognize by the flow and movement, the clockwork of the flow and movement of planets, where planets will be, where stars will be in relationship to one another for centuries, for millennia to come. In Judaism, we have this same exact teaching. And that is why every 28 years, we have something called Birchat HaChama, the blessing of the sun. Because we recognize there is a cycle of every 28 years of the flow of the earth in relationship to the sun, and restores to its point of origin every 28 years. Just like we have the new moon once a month. These cycles of time are important because they will explain to us the ways and flows of humanity. A case in point, which I made reference to earlier and I didn't get to, but now I will. As I said, the Earth flows through the astrological symbols every month, and that's why we call them the signs of the zodiac. Well, just as like we go through the signs every month, there is also an epochal movement of the planet Earth and our sun as the entire solar system revolves in relationship to the planets. And we are in an alignment with a different constellation in every period of a 2,000-year block of time. So, say we look out over tens of thousands of years. Now, you can say, well, gee, that's all well and good, but what does it have to do with us? And the answer is everything. Pharaoh in Egypt was a master of knowing the ways of the stars too. He understood the power of the name God, of Elohim, and recognized the power of nature. It was this supernatural existence of Yud-Ke-Vav-Ke, of Hashem, that he couldn't grasp in the hands of Moses, and of course it's the whole purpose of Torah. But Pharaoh recognized the power of his day, and the astrological power of his day, that was the indirect influence over Earth at that time, was the symbol of Aries. And Aries at that time was not only a ram, it was symbolized by a sheep. And that is why in ancient Egypt, the religion was of sheep worship. Jacob and his sons knew this very well. And that's why when they went down originally to Egypt, they said to Pharaoh, "We're shepherds. We take care of sheep." The implication was, we eat sheep. We're carnivores. And in those days, the Egyptians, the sheep was the holy animal. And if you're eating sheep, that shows that you're so distanced and removed from Elohim, you have no concept of the natural flow of the universe, you're a low-life people, go stay up there in Goshen. And that's how they maintained their separation. Now this is also very important, because if you remember, at Passover, God commanded the Jewish people to sacrifice the sheep. Why? God was in essence making a statement, we're sacrificing your God. We're showing you that the forces and power of nature and your astrology is itself subject to a higher power called Hashem. And this was the radical meaning behind the Passover sacrifice. It was a statement against the astrological limitations of which God himself created, and which, of course, he was now introducing a higher level of revelation. After the age of Aries, as the system moves backwards, came the 2,000-year period of Pisces. Pisces is the time of the fish. And that era began right about the time of the destruction of the Holy Temple. And of course, exists for a period of 2,000 years, ending right about now or a few years ago. And this 2,000-year period under the astrological epoch of Pisces. Pisces, as you know, is the fish. Now here's an interesting little tidbit. What has been the most predominant and influential power on planet Earth over the last 2,000 years? And the answer clearly and unequivocally has to be the Christian Church, whose original symbol, if you remember, was the ichthus, the symbol of the fish, the power of the Pisces. And now we're coming into another period of time where in which the Pisces has gone, and now Aquarius is coming. Aquarius is the water bearer, the one who pours forth the water. And that is why many people, you know, you've heard the song back in the 1960s, the dawning of the age of Aquarius. That's what it's talking about. And the Aquarian age is said to be the time of what we call the coming of the Mashiach, the coming of the Messiah, the pouring forth of the waters from heaven, the revelation of knowledge and truth. And this is just the ways that God ordained the epochs of time to flow. That's why he says they shall serve as omens. They define festivals, days, and years. And that's how it is. He speaks of the day, the great light of the sun, the light of the moon. There are many stories told about the relationship of the two, but we don't have to get into them right now. It's important, though, that, again, we stay true to the text and recognize, as it says right here in verse 18, that they are to rule. And the concept of rulership, I believe, we've understood well. Why is it now here on day 4 as opposed to the earlier time? And the answer is, this doesn't necessarily have to be chronological. But if you will, it's spiritual in its application. What is the purpose of these lights? To rule. The verse says, you cannot have a king without a people. The people must come before the king is ordained. And so the earth was created, and the plant life was created first, before its rulers were placed above them to rule over them. So the earth came first, and then came the lords over the earth, to direct and control the movement on the earth, if you will, like traffic lights. And now from here, we move on. Because what now comes forth? Day 5. God said, let the waters teem with living creatures, and flying creatures shall fly over the land on the face of the heavenly sky. And God thus created great sea monsters, along with every particular species of living thing that crawls, with which the water teems, and every particular species of winged flying creature. God saw that it was good. God blessed them, said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters of the sea, and the flying creatures multiply in the land. Evening, morning, fifth day. Under the influence now of the movement and cycles of nature, only when that relationship has been established, where the mechanical clockwork of relationship of heaven and earth has been established, so that the flow of God's energy and light now is going to come into the precision forms of created beings. Because up until now, all we have is the plant life. Created beings now come forth. And the first thing that comes forth is life from the sea. How interesting that science has come to that same conclusion, many centuries after it's written here in the Torah. And flying creatures, nothing is on the land yet, but only, if you will, birds and fish. But is that really what it says? Notice that the flying creatures multiply on the land, so they're actually on the land. And it says here, God created the great sea monsters. The Hebrew words are tininim. Tininim actually is translated as dragons. Dragons. Dinosaurs? Possibly. Or maybe they're actual dragons. Mention of dragons is found in later books of the Bible. Indeed, even in the book of Job, there is a clear and overt reference to what we have always considered to be a mythological creature called the phoenix. The phoenix is a bird which says goes into its nest after a long period of time, spontaneously combusts, and out of its ashes is reborn. Job makes clear reference to this bird. I don't believe that he would have been making reference of a myth. People have always questioned, well, if God created the universe, where did the dinosaurs come from? Obviously, God enabled their creation too. Were they all wiped out by the cause of some great meteor which changed the environment of the earth or not? I don't know. Science presents that as a theory today. But an interesting point of scientific theoretical development is that originally they believed that dinosaurs were related to lizards. And we've all seen the big movies where the dinosaurs all look like lizards. Modern or more recent understandings of the dinosaurs puts them in relationship more with birds than with reptiles. And they say that dinosaurs evolved not into modern lizards, but into modern birds. Go see your science. The relationship of the creatures of the sea to the creatures of the land. Again, science is catching up with the Torah. So, were there real dragons? Well, we have dinosaur bones. Are there species of animals that we no longer know of today? Well, we know many have been extinct. I'll share with you a very interesting side note here. When the tabernacle was built later in the wilderness, and Moses was commanded by God to take the skins of a certain animal to cover the portions of the tabernacle in the Ark of the Covenant. It was a specific animal referred to as a tachash in the Bible. How do you translate a tachash? Well, that's a good question. Apparently, no one has ever seen a tachash. In the Talmud, they give a description of the animal. The animal was said to have looked like a horse, but it had a single horn growing out of its forehead. And you might guess and say, oh, that sounds like a unicorn. yeah, I guess it does, doesn't it? Am I saying that the skins, the animal skins that covered the Holy Ark of the Covenant, were the skins of a unicorn? According to the way that Jewish rabbis have understood the Bible and Talmud, that's exactly what I'm saying. Well, if that's so, where are the unicorns today? Well, that's also a good question. And the answer is, I don't know. Where's the phoenix bird today? I don't know. Where are dragons today? I don't know. Where are dinosaurs today? I don't know. But I will say that we do not know, in spite of our arrogant protestations, the opposite. We don't know everything about science or zoology. There are new species being discovered all the time. And there's even teachings that are not referenced here in the book of Genesis so much, but hinted to throughout the Bible and spoken of in great depth throughout Judaic teachings about creations under the earth and not on just the surface of the earth. And that it's in the inner earth that many of these creatures might have survived. Because our rabbis said about the Tahash that it only was manifest in the days of Moses and then was concealed again. Curious. But we don't have more that we can say about this. We do know the progression of life coming out of the seas, flying in the air, and this apparently is the natural order of things. What more can be said? Many legends, many stories. But let's stay true to our text and go now to day 6. God said, let the earth bring forth particular species of living creatures, particular species of livestock, land animals, beasts. And it happened. God thus made particular species of beasts on the earth, particular species of livestock, particular species of animals that walk the land. And God saw that it was good. Okay? Creation of animal life. Let's not digress because of our time. Let's discuss what's important now. God said, and here are those so radical words, let us make man in our image and our likeness. Let him dominate over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, livestock, animals, and all the earth, and every land animal that walks in the earth. Thus God created man in his singular image. The image of God, he created the male and female, he created them. This lesson said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the land and conquer it, dominate the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and every beast that walks the land. Wow. What is this plural here in the creation of man? This has caused such consternation and theological problems throughout so many millennia, centuries of people who have come to read the Bible outside of its original Hebraic context. And people cannot understand what on earth is going on here. They will point to the etymology of the Hebrew word Elohim, which ends with the two Hebrew letters Yud and Mem, which is a plural ending, saying, aha, God is plural, speaking of many gods. And you and I could say, oh, that's nothing. But in olden days, that was meant something significant. But again, as I said, Elohim is that name of God as it is revealing nature. You see, God worked in partnership with nature. What we did not discuss were the creation of the angels. And the reason why we didn't discuss it is because the Bible really doesn't make mention of it. Remember we spoke back on day 2 of the waters above the heavens? Apparently, from our sources, that's where the angels come from. And that on day 4, God created the mechanics of the stars and the mechanical operations of the universe. And above them are the waters above the heaven, or the angels. There's a relationship between angels and the stars. The angels are the ones who control the mechanics of the stars. And above these angels, of course, it's God and his throne. And from God and his throne emanate the souls of mankind. So you have this hierarchy God, the souls, the angels, the mechanics of the stars and the planets, and then the earth. And everything goes down through, if you will, the pipeline. God did not use the angels to create. But when he spoke about creating man, he spoke to the earth. And he said, I now need a bridge to anchor the top of the link of the chain to the bottom of the link of the chain. I, God, am the top of the link of the chain, and the earth beneath is the bottom link of the chain. So we together are going to form a man in our image and likeness. Why does it have two words, image and likeness? Because God is spiritual. God has no physical form. God has no hands or eyes or mouth or nose. And even though the Bible uses those metaphors when it speaks about God, it's speaking in a symbolic language to help us understand. But yet, we were created in the biological form that we are, but the image that we speak of is our spiritual form. Physically, we are created, if you will, in the likeness or form of the earth, because we are physical human beings. We are born from physical matter, and we revert to physical matter. But the true essence which makes us us is that spiritual component which God places in us. And that is the composite nature of the human reality. So when it says here, let us make man, it's speaking of the combination of the physical and spiritual components which join and unite and make us uniquely human. And only because we have that physical component that we can be called the pinnacle of the physical creation. And that is why we dominate the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock and all the other earth and every living animal that walks the earth. And then it changes that God created man in his image. Because the image spoken of here is the spiritual image. The image of God being both male and female. Male and female is both spiritual and physical. Giving, receiving. Active, passive. A dichotomy, a flow, a movement. Biologically, we all know the difference between the male and female of the species, except for those who unfortunately allow themselves to be confused. But at the genetic level, I believe the difference between male and female in the species is only a single chromosome. Psychologically, the difference between us is just as simple as well. Because as it's learned in psychology, within the conscious man resides his unconscious female side. And within every woman, the conscious female, inside her resides the unconscious male side. And the reason how love works, marriage works, is that we come and activate and complement the inner opposite of the other. So when a man marries and is joined with his wife, she activates his inner femininity and enables him to integrate, to become a completely whole human being created in the image of God, male and female combined. And he activates within her, her inner male, enabling her to integrate and become complete and whole, to be in the image of God combined. And therefore you see, as men and women marry and mature, many of the masculine traits are found adopted by the woman, and many of the feminine traits are found adopted by the man. And in successful marriages, we see that the man is the active one in certain roles of the family, whereas the woman is the active role in certain elements of the family. The man is the more passive in certain elements of the family, where in other things the woman is. All depending on its relationship to the world, to the home, to the family. This is the natural order of things. It is innate within us spiritually, psychologically, biologically. And when we lose sight of this, when we lose sight of the natural order of things, we become confused. And therefore, in the mistakes of the intellect, we create an environment, a society, which gets twisted out of shape and lost from truth. And that, of course, unfortunately, is in the history of humanity. So this is the creation of man. Now I'm going to finish the first chapter with these last few verses. The quick note. God said, "Behold, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit shall be for you for food. Every beast of the field, every bird of the sky, and everything that walks the land, that it has a living soul, all plant vegetation shall be food." And that's the way it was. God saw that all he made, and behold, it was very good. Evening, morning, day six, sixth day. Ha, yom hashishi. God originally ordained for all creation to be vegetarian. In this initial state, not even carnivorous animals ate flesh. Everything ate vegetation. Man originally was vegetarian. That was the original way of things, and it wasn't until after the flood that God enabled and ordained man to eat meat. Many people turn to this and say, aha, that's proof that vegetarianism is a high level of spirituality and we should all adopt it. To which I respond and say, the time when the entire world was vegetarian, the entire world was so wicked and evil that God had to wipe them out with a flood. So I'm not so sure that a whole world being vegetarian is a good thing, because the last time it happened, it led to the destruction practically of all humanity. But initially that was the state. We are no longer at this state, as we will proceed into the stories in our later chapters to find out why. But on this note, God be willing, we have concluded chapter 1. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen.